Yes, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the 49th installment of the Godfathers of Podcasting. You know we've been podcasting since before podcasting was even called podcasting. The video version of this show and all of our archives are available free on our website at godfathersofpodcasting.com. The audio version is available on major podcast providers everywhere, including Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, iHeartRadio, and many, many more. While you're on our website, check out our brand new merchandise, including the surprising bestseller, The Godfathers of Podcasting Cooking Apron. Who knew? This week's episode is brought to you by Kangol Hats, Camelback, Coffee Friend, Eyeglasses.com, Air Vape, Fight TV, Natalie Attire, Just CBD, and NordVPN. My name is Donnie Da Silva, and it is my pleasure to introduce the Francis Ngannou and Johnny Bones Jones to my Stipe Miocic. It's Notorious D.I.D. Chris Tidwell and your bro, Danny O.
Yo, I hope that means that you're retiring.
It means I was the greatest of all time, and nobody cares anymore.
Yeah, at heavyweight, you had four victories to defend your belt.
That's all it takes in MMA, right? You had four heavyweight fights. He's the greatest of all time
in the heavyweight division. But John Jones, I mean, come on. You talk about how many times he defended.
He's the craziest of all time.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. So that makes him John Jones.
Is he also up there as one of the biggest disappointments of all time? And I say that because of his incredible in-octagon skill comparable to his outside-of-the-octagon fuckery. If he was able to do away with one, would he be the greatest at the other?
I mean, it depends on who you ask. If you ask Donnie's mom, then it's going to be Donnie.
His outside-of-the-ring fuckery has definitely contributed to his problems because it's caused him multiple suspensions, paydays lost, fights lost, opportunities
for
lost.
For sure, man.
It's had him lose titles that he never actually lost in the ring.
Right.
There's all sorts of issues that have come as a result of getting arrested for drunk driving, getting into public fights.
It's too much, man.
Does that go into your, because they talk about, you know, greatest of all time and stuff like that, right? Especially with MMA fighters and that. Does that go into your criteria?
It does for me. Absolutely.
It does for me as well, too, right? Yeah. Like you can have, but you still need to, like, as an athlete, you need to have some kind of moral fiber outside of what you do. I get the whole, like, we're not here to be your role model thing, but I mean, illegal activity is illegal activity.
Yeah, that's part of it. But I'm also before I even delve into that side of it, I'm looking at it from the perspective of your ability as a fighter. And to Donnie's point, you've missed so many opportunities to defend titles, to rack up those wins, and to be able to lay claim to being the greatest ever, whether it's win streak, title holds, defenses, whatever. And he's been out of the octagon too often for dumb shit to hold on to a legacy that seems that high, as far as rankings.
We ask about the athlete and their moral fiber and how important that is. Our guest this week is an athlete with incomparable moral fiber. We can touch on that topic with her later.
Definitely part of it.
So my thought, my sort of summation of what happened this past Saturday, for anyone who missed it, even if you're not a UFC fan, it's a really fascinating sort of breakdown. The fight that happened this past Saturday, the main event of the show, was the reigning and defending and universally regarded as the greatest heavyweight of all time, Stipe Miocic, went in there to fight Francis Ngannou. And Francis Ngannou lost to Stipe Miocic about 3 years ago.
Correct.
And it was a loss by decision, but it was a decision. But I mean, Tid, I think you agree, Miocic was not in danger of losing that fight at any time, right?
No. The Francis Ngannou of 3 years ago was not who you've seen in his last couple of fights.
Different guy.
His first foray into a title fight.
Right.
He was thrown into a lot of all the media and everything
He was a puncher.
He did not, you know what I mean, against a wrestler who has a very good takedown and has a very, just a very, very strong dude in Miocic, who's, you know, heavyweight champion.
So in the first few seconds of this fight, I saw Miocic try to take down Francis Ngannou, and Ngannou sprawls, and Miocic can't get him down. And I went, "Uh-oh, somebody learned defense." It reminded me of that.
That reminds me of Cookie Monster.
No, that was like the Adam Sandler movie, you know. Uh-oh, Happy learned how to putt.
Yeah, but that voice impression right there sounded like you're eating cookies.
Okay, so I am. But when I saw the Sprawled, I thought, this is not going to go well for Stipe, because Ngannou is 30 pounds bigger. He's muscular. He's younger. He's in shape. You know, he's at the peak level of his game, and now he's added weapons to his fight game.
And you forgot the most important part. He got tips from Mike Tyson.
Yeah.
like he's got some new tricks, because he's been working with some new people. Like, this is a completely different dude.
And that when he went in there, nasty. That knockout was nasty. Like, Miocic's leg just went and it just buckled underneath him.
Would not have got his, the way that he fell back on his foot, if his foot wouldn't have popped out, his ankle, and he'd be done for a very, very long time, because he probably could have very well snapped his Achilles doing that. There is no doubt about it, in the way that Ngannou has been fighting lately, especially with that, like, they talk about Stipe, you know, doing a trilogy, having an immediate rematch for this and whatnot. I don't think an immediate rematch is even in the cards for that, because there wasn't any kind of, there was no question about it. Stipe got starched.
But that's the bad way. Now, I agree with you, because Dana White was talking in the post conference about, you know, people, the fans want to see Ngannou versus Johnny Bones Jones. That's what they want to see. And then, you know, not to bog down with names for the people listening that aren't UFC fans, but Dana White, the president of UFC, is saying, look, we already have a number one contender that was ready to step in and fight the winner of this fight, and it's not John Jones. So that guy also deserves consideration for a fight. I don't think that John Jones is serious. If I was John Jones, I'd go back down to light heavyweight after seeing what Francis Ngannou just did. John Jones immediately gets on Twitter and says, fuck it, let's do it. Show me the money. To which Dana responds in the press conference, when guys say show me the money, a lot of times that's their way of saying, you know, I'm going to price myself right out of this fight. Mm-hmm. So, I agree with you, Tid. Miocic got handed. But to me, the champion always deserves a rematch.
Does he, though?
He had a bad day. And then again, he's 38 years old. Like, maybe he just hangs him up for good. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't think he deserves any kind of rematch on that one. I think that the heavyweight division needs to continue and move on. I think Stipe kind of held down that division for the longest time, if you think about it, because his last, his last three fights were against the same dude. You know what I mean?
Well, so, and he's not an active fighter, right?
No. So let's get that thing happening. Let's get it going, because people pay to see the heavyweights. And now you've got a heavyweight champion that people are going to really pay to see, because you have not one. Usually a fighter is lucky if he can get a highlight reel on that UFC opener. And this is a guy who has not one, but at least two solid ones. You know what I mean? And recent solid ones. So let's make it happen. Screw it. You know what I mean? If John Jones doesn't want the money that the UFC is going to give him, that he is contractually obligated to take, regardless of what people say, if he doesn't want to take that money, then, you know, the guy that you're talking about who wants that fight, Derek Lewis, has already said, screw it. Give me $8 million. I'll do it. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So that's already happening in place. So the UFC has some interesting stuff. More importantly is the fact that they've just now are 100%. The deal has closed, and now Endeavor owns the UFC full-heartedly. So one of the things that they're going to be wanting to do is to take this to an IPO, to take this thing publicly. Doing so, then that means that the people are going to have a lot more control, a lot more say in what, you know, happens in the UFC. So the UFC is going to have to become very much more fan or, you know, consumer friendly.
You know what else it means? And Dan, I'm curious to know your thoughts on this. Once the UFC does, as rumored, take out an initial public offering and has publicly traded stock, you know, you as a guy that used to follow the WWE very closely, you'll remember 20, 25 years ago when the WWE did this move, they went from being a privately owned family business to a publicly traded company. And they went from being $1 million company to $1 billion company almost overnight. And then all of a sudden the paydays of the individual talents went from $100,000 to $5 million, just like that. So I think what's going to happen, I'm curious to know your thought as a performer, as a freelancer, how you would feel if you're a fighter right now in the UFC hearing rumors of an IPO and going, oh, here comes the cheddar, right?
Well, it's funny you should say that, because you talked about the guest that we're going to be having on our show today. And she's obviously a Canadian athlete. And sometimes I wonder about, and actually I know, because I know some Canadian athletes, and I think about the parallels between Canadian athletes and Canadian entertainers and how difficult it is for many of us to even get started in the game. And it's finance that's the problem. It's funding. It's getting an investor or someone to believe in you, to back you. So if I'm in the position that you're hypothetically putting me in, I'm thinking, shit, a payday is gonna sound great for what I'm doing, for the talent that I have, for the skills that I know I'm able to use during my performance. And now I'm gonna get paid for it in a way that I've always felt was fair. It reminds me too of the Carlos Newton interview we did on this podcast, and the fact that, you know, he considered it unfair for, you know, fighters to be relegated to one company and not have opportunities such as the one that you're presenting. And I think that, you know, I would be surprised if the paydays raise that much that any fighter would have a problem with that.
Yeah, no one's going to have a problem with it. I just think it's going to create a lot more TID. Don't you think it's going to create a lot more of these, I ain't fighting until you show, because up to this point, the only guys that have really done that are really Johnny Bones Jones and Conor McGregor.
But not everyone can get away with that, right? Like, we know the difference between the headliner cats, and the cats are like, I need that payday, give me the fight.
Yeah, so that's when it comes down to it. And every fighter thinks that he's worth 100 million buys. But there's very few fighters out there that are actually capable of pulling in that amount that amount of cash. And guess what? John Jones is not one of those guys. Everybody thinks they can pull in Conor numbers, but they're not pulling in Conor numbers. Mm. You know what I mean? Now, a lot of that could also be on the amount of promotion that those events might be getting, because, you know, it's kind of like, okay, we only have to pay out this much. So let's put this much into it. And we have to pay Conor this much, so we have to put this much more into it. And in doing so, it gets, you know, it's kind of like that back and forth.
Are you saying Bones Jones couldn't command that payday?
No, I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying that he very well could. I'm saying that he hasn't. I'm saying that he hasn't got those numbers up to this point.
Now, keep in mind, earlier in John Bones Jones' career, he did have some very big pay-per-view numbers. I think personally what happened, and you started to see this over the last couple of fights with Israel Adesanya, the fans have gotten to the point where they go, he's going to fucking murder whoever he's in the cage with. Mm. So the appeal to watch is lessened, because you already have an idea of what the result's going to be. And guess what? 10 minutes after the fight's done, it's on YouTube. So people are like, I'm not going to go crazy to watch Johnny Bones Jones mash some guy up. If they actually believe there was a chance he could lose.
Yeah. I feel like Amanda Nunes is not in that. She's fallen in that category.
Well, I don't think that Amanda Nunes is going to fight John Jones.
that would be a compelling fight, though.
You know what would be a compelling fight? How about Amanda Nunes versus Derek Chauvin?
Oh, I would love to see that fight.
Listen.
Would love to see that fight.
I think at this point, anything that does Derek Chauvin any kind of bodily harm whatsoever would be pleasantly accepted by a number of people, because this, you know, you talk, for those that are not educated enough and you're still listening to this show, you're talking about the Derek Chauvin trial, the George Floyd incident where a police officer murdered a do-nothing by himself bystander, and the trial has now started. And this has been ridiculous because it seems like Derek Chauvin is not actually the one on trial.
Right.
So far, we're at, you know, 4 or 5, you know, days into this thing. And it seems like that the only thing that everybody on the defense side can seem to talk about is George Floyd's addiction or his problems, his character. And I get that. I get that. You try to do that all the time. You try to put down the character and whatnot to do so. But that is not what is on trial. What is on trial is the cop that murdered somebody.
Yeah,
and he should get everything that is coming to him, 100%.
Guys, our guest just joined. Before we get to that, though, let me just share this with you, Dan. I think you'll get a kick out of this, okay?
I think Officer Chauvin was just doing his job.
Nope, you're just a racist.
Well, I think he's just the victim of a liberal mob.
Nope, you're just a racist.
It was self-defense.
There was no attack.
He was threatening, right?
No, he was black. Whatever your counter-argumentative case is, the fact is you're just a racist. Black Lives Matter and your president lost.
Yeah,
I mean, get a kick out of that.
I mean, you know, it's one thing. Like, I do get a kick out of that and everything. But, you know, something that needs to be said is that this trial, before we went to air, we were talking about when was the last time a trial of this magnitude was presented and broadcast daily and had this many implications with respect to race relations in the States and in the world, for that matter. Sure. And we hearken back to the Rodney King police, you know, who got off. But something that's been said on the show that really does need to be reiterated here, and it's important I say two things here about this, is that one, there has never, not to my recollection or knowledge, been as clear-cut evidence as the video that we've all seen of George Floyd's murder. There isn't even a cutaway. It doesn't even go fuzzy. You know what I'm saying? It doesn't go black and white. Like, it's not far off in the distance. It couldn't be clearer. So, you got all these people testifying to stuff we've all seen. And one of the things that drives me crazy, point number two, is something that you guys touched on, is who's really on trial here? I get that the defense attorney has a job to do. I understand that. But what I can't understand for the life of me is how anyone could possibly buy the idea that someone like Donald Williams, the bystander, who was also an MMA fighter, who happened to be calling him things like bum, was brought into question as if somehow that was enough of a distraction for the cops to not perhaps realize what they were doing, or perhaps it was on him. And I actually tweeted this out and said, to be called a bum and a bitch was actually polite when he was watching a murderer in action. And all I have to say is, if this case, of all cases, isn't one that ends in an absolute guilty verdict, I can't see there ever being any hope for there to be any sort of healing, not just for this situation, but the entire situation, which is racial division in this world.
Agreed.
It's clear cut, man.
Well said. We will talk more about that story in the weeks to come, because we know it's not going away anytime soon. But ladies and gentlemen, right now it is time for the big hello. And our featured guest this week, she is a best-selling author, an advocate for children, a coveted keynote speaker, a writer, and a life coach. And that in and of itself is pretty impressive. But this incredible woman became a beloved Canadian icon as an elite athlete and a 4-time Olympic rower. She won a bronze medal at the 84 LA Games and a silver at the 96 Olympics in Atlanta, but everyone remembers the bronze she won in 92, just 10 weeks after suffering a horrific leg injury in a highly publicized accident. Oh, and she's also a 4-time world champion, just sprinkle that in. And she has a Pan Am gold, and she should have another one, but Benadryl's packaging is stupid. The Canadian Association for the Advancement of Women in Sport has named her their most influential woman 3 times. She's won the prestigious Lou Marsh Award as Canada's Outstanding Athlete and was twice named Female Athlete of the Year by the Canadian Press. She's been inducted into multiple halls and in 2015 was immortalized on Canada's Walk of Fame. Reaching beyond sport, the Globe and Mail named her Canada's most influential woman 8 years after her athletic career ended. She's also received honorary doctorates from the University of Victoria, McMaster, Windsor, Laurentian, and Western. Her not-for-profit foundation, Unsinkable, which shares the same name as her best-selling memoir, is all about helping people improve their mental health. And as if all that wasn't enough, she's lent her name and her voice to other amazing causes like Right to Play, Good Life Kids, and more. She's also a hiker, a skier, a yoga enthusiast, a mom, a loving wife, a pet owner, and during this pandemic, she decided to start some podcasting and become a portrait artist and, you know, just master that too. I once read her biggest fear in life was not living well, and after running down this list of accomplishments, I feel like I haven't lived at all. Earlier today, our mutual friend Biff Naked told me that this woman should be the next Prime Minister of Canada. Ladies and gentlemen, join me in welcoming a woman who didn't wear a stitch of makeup until she was in her 40s. She's a champion at this thing we call life, the incomparable Silken Lauman.
Wow. Yeah, there were things in there that I didn't even know about. thanks, Tony. That's the thing, eh? If you get older, like your bio and your CV just gets longer. It's like you've done all this stuff, but you just lived a long time.
But my gosh, like, listen, we do these big overdrawn introductions for everybody. And sometimes it's a little hard for me to put stuff together because there's not a lot of material. But like with you, it's one of those things where it's like, I got to sift through and cut things out because there's so much. My God, when you think about the multiple halls of fame, the Canada Walk of Fame, all like the doctorates, like, do I call you Dr. Silken?
Like, just like doctor. I'm like, and every time I get a little smarter, that's what, you know, at least.
Like, of all of those things, now, like, the athletic accomplishments aside, right? And I know a lot of the athletics led to a lot of those things, of course. But so did your philanthropic work and everything else. What stands out to you as the most mind-blowing of all of those honors?
That's such a great question. Because, like, in some of the ways, I really feel like right now I'm living my best life. Like, right now is the most exciting time. I think there's definitely moments in athletics where I really remember crossing the finish line in the semifinal of the World Championships in 1990 and realizing that I just beat the two best racers in the world and going like, oh my God, I've arrived. Like it's funny because a couple of my rower friends have said, like, do you dream of rowing? It's amazing. Like, so many years later, like, I still, oh my gosh, I'm late for the race in my dream, or I forgot the name.
Yeah. I'm making
this remarkable, like, comeback in my 50s. it's such a short period of your life.
Right.
Or of my life. I mean, I actually rode a lot longer than most people do. I went to 4 Olympics, 13 years of international. Yeah. Amazing. But it has this huge influence. And as you said, Donnie, it's so fair and it's so true. It opened up a lot of doors for me. And I walked through them. And so I've been very fortunate that my athletic career did lead and create some very unusual and special opportunities.
Yeah, it's absolutely amazing. And I think there's got to be times when, you know, whether it's the Walk of Fame or it's the Canadian Sports Hall of Fame or whether it's the Canadian Press saying, you're the best or whatever it was. Yeah. Sometimes there's got to be like that pinch me moment where you're like, me? Really? Yeah, me? The girl from Mississauga? Me?
Yeah, totally. And you see it in other athletes too, right? And I don't think I've ever lost that sort of sense of like, oh gosh, golly, like, I can't believe this is happening. But I've also kind of, you know, stepped into my own power and my own, where I am in my life. But I do think the Walk of Fame, you know, that was pretty special. And there's not that many amateur athletes that are part of the Walk of Fame, a lot of movie stars, a lot of, directors, that kind of thing. So, you literally have a red carpet and, you know, get dressed off. You know, I had my makeup done. Because as I said, I barely know how to put on makeup. I mean, just in my 50s.
Dr. Lauman.
That's Dr.
Just keep going.
I'm missing a few doctors, but I don't want to take as long as Donnie to begin my question. I'm just so curious because, first of all, I just want to thank you for doing the show. I'm such a big sports fan. I'm a Blue Jays fan, and the season started today. But as Donnie and Tid also know, I'm such a huge fan of Canadian athletes. Every Olympics, I don't care what the sport is, I'm watching skating and things that I would never, because I care so much about Canadians winning. So firstly, thank you and congratulations at the amazing accomplishments. But I'm curious, because we could continue running down this list, but what's the one that really sticks to your heart? Because I get this sense that it's not necessarily the golds or the Hall of Fame, but is there one that had a personal meaning to you? Like, for example, the bronze after the injury, or like, what is the one that sticks out to you? Is like, this is the one that means the most to me, regardless of what people think.
Well, okay, so the bronze definitely was special because there was kind of also this surreal element to it, because I was massively injured. I mean, my body literally healing from a skin graft, and I had a hole in my leg, and I had a broken ankle, and I tendon and ligament and nerve damage, everything. So it was like my body was in big time healing mode. So I think in a way that Olympics, I don't almost remember it. I know it sounds kind of bad, but I was on the water, or I was in the recovery room icing my leg, or I was sleeping, and so it was special. And I certainly like can reflect on moments. And I think it's been very fundamental in my life, in that it really, really showed me the power of our minds. Like what I did was not physically possible. I really believe that. But I think the moment, so let's just put that aside for a second, because I think, I think the moment that I really like savored the most and just felt so incredibly joyful for was when I won the world championships in 1991, the year before the Olympics. And it was such a windy day. And I'm a fair size human for regular humans, but not for rowers. And it was one of those days where it was like a headwind, and it really favored the girl that was like the woman that was like 40 pounds more than me. And I was like, oh shoot, you know. And then we had this epic race where the lead literally changed 7 times in a 2000 meter race. And I just kind of broke her right at the end. And I had that 20 strokes to go like, oh my God, I'm going to win the world championships. Like, you know, so that kind of stands out like as this huge high. And it and I was fully present for it, where I think for the 92 thing, there was so much media pressure. There was so much build up. There was this level of exhaustion that I can't even describe in my body and in my soul, I think, having gone through all the things that I have, that I probably appreciate the 92 more for what it taught me than the actual moment I was in it.
That's awesome.
Well, and the buildup for 92, I remember it well. You were one of the very heavily marketed Canadian medal hopefuls. So considering what you were dealing with physically at the time, the pressure must have been crazy. But Silken, I know you've talked about this 100,000 times, maybe more, but I am also cognizant of the fact that we have international listeners that may not be necessarily familiar with your story, and, you know, millennials and Gen Zers and everything else that, you know, weren't even alive when that happened. I mean, all of us remember what happened May 15th in 1992. We remember it well. But can you take us back to that day and try to just sort of paint that picture?
Yeah, no, it's my pleasure, actually. So I went into the 1992 kind of Olympic season as the world champion, the World Cup champion, the fastest woman in the world. And I, you know, I was really looking for it. I really thought, you know, 92 is going to be the year. I've got a great coach. I've got a great, like all those things, like everything was lining up. And then on May 16th of the Olympic year, in a kind of warm-up race, like a World Cup race, in the warm-up area, I was broadsided by a men's pair, and their boat, you know, just crashed into the side of my boat, kind of broadsided my boat, and my boat was wooden, and it splintered. And it drove 200 odd pieces of wood into my right leg, shredding all the muscle and the tendon and the ligament and the ankle bone. And really, like, I thought at some level at that point, like, you know, the boat's sort of sinking, and the emergency patrol person is there, and I'm thinking, God, like the Olympics,
it's gone.
Yeah, it's gone. And then at the trauma center, that's exactly what they said. They said the Olympics are over. Like, you got massive injury. And I think that, like every other athlete, and I think all of you, you interview so many athletes, like, you know, we're really focused. And I think even on the athletic level, I think I'm hyper focused. I have that ability. And I was just like, not going to go to the Olympics. Mm-hmm. Like, I was like, not letting that dream go, because right. It's clearly what I thought about, like, every single minute of my day. And the first thing I thought about when I got up in the morning for over a decade. And so, you know, while I was still in the hospital, I was like, you know what, I'm going to go for it.
Yeah.
And I did all sorts of, like, there was nothing high tech about my recovery. Like, back in time, it's like, go back to 92. You know, I had like little arm weights and, you know, TheraBands, and we adapted one of the leg lifting machines so that I could use my quads. I was in the hospital for 21 days, like 10 weeks before the Olympic Games. Yeah, days. And I got out of the hospital, and a week and a half later, I was flying to Europe, still using a cane.
Wow.
And I mean, it's still almost inconceivable to me for, you know, as I sort of think about how badly injured I was, and my injury is still an issue today. I mean, there's still lots of things I can't do, and I had many surgeries since, and yet there I was in the final of the Olympic Games.
What was your expected recovery time versus the amount of time it took to get you race ready?
Well, I was actually told I would never row at the Olympic level.
Ever. Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm. Tid, I know you want to jump in, but I just want to throw this out there really quick, and then I'll let you jump in, because I know Tid has a personal connection to your story, Silken. But I just want to throw this out there, because my personal rowing experience is limited to a few regattas when I was a camp kid as a teenager, and that's about it. I don't know anything I don't know anything about being a good technical rower, other than the fact that, as opposed to what the general public may believe from just watching, there's a lot more legs involved than people think.
Oh, right? Yeah.
Like, a lot of your power is coming from your legs. So, like, how much does that, like, I don't think people really fully grasp. You were essentially competing for a medal with one working leg.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think where, you know, where I got lucky, if you can say that in these situations, is that it was my lower leg. So my calf, knee down kind of thing, right? Had it been my quadriceps, because you're getting about 65% of your power from your lower body, right? So it's like it is a full body sport, but your legs are so powerful.
Yeah.
And so my quads were still intact. Right. So it was more the calf muscle, the balance, and also just the pain of I had an open wound. You know, I had a skin graft that was still healing while at Olympics. Yeah.
Did you have to make any kind of technical changes to your technique?
Yeah, you know, I look back at it, and I think I was probably a little bit shorter. Because I didn't have the comfortable range in my ankle. Mm-hmm. I dropped my footboard a little bit so that, you know, I had less pressure on my ankle. When I first got into the boat, we actually had like one side of the footboard moved to take pressure off the ankle. But actually the hardest thing was, what was funny was, like, it was really hard to get in and out of the boat. It was hard to walk around. But once I got into the rowing shell, because your feet are in front of you, so your blood isn't just all flowing down to the damaged limb. Mm. I was actually a lot more comfortable rowing than I was walking or sitting or doing anything else.
Interesting.
Well, yeah, you go back to that original time when the injury happens and you're in the hospital bed and you're laying there in the bed and they tell you, you know, it's got to be elevated. So it's got to be above the heart, and you're there for days, like days. It's got to be a couple of surgeries and everything like that. And then that first time that they stand you up or they sit you on the edge of the bed, has there ever been any pain in your life? Like all of that blood rushing back to your leg the first time?
Well, I mean,
the reason I asked that,
maybe childhood.
The reason I got two children, right? Yeah. Back, yeah. The reason I asked that, because as a male, I will never experience childbirth like that. But I can remember very distinctly that was some of the worst pain that I had ever felt in my life. So to give you an idea for myself, it was April 19th, 2007. Right. Mm-hmm. It was about 2:30 in the afternoon. It was very sunny. There was a slight breeze coming out of the west. I can remember distinctly, just like I'm sure you remember the day, everything. You remember all of the things that were going on around you and what you were doing when the accident happened. For myself, I had about 6,000 pounds worth of steel hit me in the chest and fall on my left leg that caused my knee to go completely this way, my ankle to turn upside down. I was looking at the bottom of my toes. I had a double compound fracture in my tibia and fibula, and the entire front part of my shin, that whole shin muscle, was laying out on the ground.
Sounds a lot like Silken Story, actually.
This is what I'm saying. Like, that lower leg injury is like, it takes it out of you very much. And it's funny because it was a year after my injury. I had a rod put in there for a year. It was bugging me. I went for my 1-year checkup afterwards, and the doctor says to me, "Have you thought about going back to work?" And I said, "Doc, I hate to tell you this, but I've been wrestling already for 6 months now." Like, I was like, much like that's why I was smiling when you were talking about you would not let it happen to you. Mm-hmm. You would not accept that this was going to be something that happened to you. Mm-hmm. How important was it to you? Like, did you find that you felt like you had an obligation more to yourself to get back up there and get it going? Or was it you had the obligation of the country, because, you know what I mean, being the iconic Canadian athlete and what was at stake and what was coming up? What really was going through your mind at the time?
Yeah, I think it's more selfish than that. I mean, you know, what I represent to others is what I represent to others, but what has always mattered is like what's inside myself, and for good and bad, right? You can never believe everything good you hear about yourself or everything rotten that you hear about yourself. And I mean, I wanted to win. I wanted to race. It had been my life. You can relate to that. It's the most important thing in your life when you're doing it. And that's just the way it is. And the idea of not being able to, it was so painful that, you know, the little thread of hope that was maybe I still could was what helped me recover. It was what got me out of the hospital bed in the first place. So I had to, I mean, it was the most sensible survival mechanism kind of mentally, is aiming for those Olympic Games.
And German engineering helps too, right?
They do build things well.
Yeah. Your never say die attitude is amazingly inspiring and necessary.
She's unsinkable.
Because I'm curious to know what advice you'd give young athletes today, because I'm imagining in 2021, mm-hmm. it's a lot different than, say, the early 90s in terms of just even the road, the path to becoming a star athlete. You know, being involved in the entertainment industry, I know how difficult it is for Canadian artists to feel like they're getting the support, financially even, investors, people to back you, someone to help you. So in terms of training, or even how to find themselves in a position where they can, you know, put themselves potentially to become an Olympic athlete, what is the difference between then and now in terms of what you're aware of, in terms of the, you know, the steps needed to take? And how would you inspire today's young athletes who want to be the next doctor?
Yeah.
Doctor.
You know, it is always a different world, right? Every few decades, things really sort of shift.
Yeah.
And I think that the core of what makes an athlete the athlete is the same. I mean, I'm certainly connecting with enough young rowers today to know that they're, you know, wide-eyed love for the sport and the desire to, you know, just be at their very best is just the same as it always has been. Like, that hasn't changed. But I mean, I think there's some things in our sport that have changed a lot. One is, I think that when I was rowing, it was very much about feeling the boat, tuning into yourself, like understanding what your body was seeing. Now there's a lot more science. And some of that's good, you know, that everybody wears heart rate monitors and they wear like meters that measure like the pressure on the oar in certain parts of the stroke. Wow. But also kind of, you know, if you're kind of more of that free spirited kind of person and you like to make your own rules and you like to do, you know, there's not a lot of room for that in sport today. And what I find about a lot of athletes who have gone far both in sport and after sport is that there often are those kind of risk takers. Yeah. I'm definitely a risk taker. I'm a freedom lover. I'm outspoken in my own way when I believe in things.
Yeah.
And I think that sport today is more constrictive. There's a lot more less freedom to just be who you are. And that's a shame because I think, I think that's generally in society, honestly, through social media and all that other influences that we have, that we don't make enough room for those outside the box thinkers, people that are a little intense, you know, and maybe do things a little differently. And sometimes those are actually going to be the people that win Olympic medals and invent stuff and run companies. I mean, I'm married to an entrepreneur, a guy who started the biggest fitness company in North America. He's a risk taker. He thinks outside the box. Sometimes he pisses people off, and there's a certain kind of profile of person that I think it's harder for that kind of person. It would be harder today for me to be successful. I would have hated all of the gadgets and all the ways and all the checks and the ways I'm not allowed to do things.
Right.
My number one value is freedom. I don't know how athletes today who have their number one value is freedom operate.
It's funny when you say that, because I think back to when we were all kids, we probably, most of us played every sport we could get our hands on, right? We played everything that was accessible and did everything and experimented with as much as we could. Today, from a very, very, very young age, athletes are identified and they are doing one sport 12 months of the year. There's no off season. If they're a hockey player, they're doing dry land training all summer. If they're a basketball player, then they're competing in tournaments all year long, whatever it is. Like for the last 20 plus years, I've been a basketball coach and I've coached some very high level athletes. And I've seen just in the last 20 years, the progression from what practice looked like 20 years ago to now, where you're right, it is so scientific. Things are recorded, monitored, videotaped. A lot of that has to do with recruiting and platform identification and all this other stuff, right? And making yourself a marketable property to the D1 schools and everything else. But it's also about injury prevention. And it's like, oh, you're putting a little bit too much torque on your left hip. Let's identify that problem and let's fix it now. And it's like, in some ways it's great. In other ways, it's like, oh my God, we're turning these kids into little robots. Yeah. You know, and it's to me, sometimes it takes some of the joy out of sport, you know?
Especially, I actually wrote a book about this in 98 or something. And it was called Child's Play. And it was all about, the subtitle was Rediscovering the Joy of Play in Our Families and Communities. And it was all about the organicness of how we used to play, right? And like the bicycle was the huge freedom, right? When you got your first bike and suddenly your neighborhood went from like the 10 blocks that you could walk to the 50 blocks that you could bike. And how, like, raising my own kids, like my little one was born in 97, my second one in 99, like I would notice that, wow, the kids weren't playing in the park. There wasn't this organic sense of neighborhood and community. And I think it comes back to kind of a little bit of what you guys were talking about before, which is like how important caring about each other really is, right? Mm-hmm. And that what happens, you know, just a mile down the road actually is happening to all of us. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was as interested, like when I wrote Child's Play, I was as interested in community as I was in the physical activity piece of it. And what happens, of course, and we all know this because you're in this world, is that kids quit. You know, kids quit sport around 13, 14.
Or don't even try.
Yeah.
If we were to take a look through your medicine cabinet right now, would we find any Benadryl?
I still am a little bitter about that.
Damn.
No kidding. Like, seriously. Yeah. Oh, my God.
Yeah. But, you know, it's funny because, like, I think back to the time and, like, I was, like, the kind of person that I think I'd taken an aspirin three times in my life. Like, I was just so... grew up with, German parents who cured everything by going outside. Like, you know, I had pneumonia and they stuck me outside on a lawn chair in a sleeping bag, you know, in November. That's how you cured pneumonia, right?
Yeah.
So, that remains a little bit, it's funny, like, I think about it now, and it was the whole unfortunate thing. So for those of you that don't know, I took a cold medication before the Pan American Games called Benadryl. There was like 11 kinds of Benadryl on the market, and I just picked up Benadryl thinking, I don't know, Benadryls. And I actually had picked it up because I had, like, my ears were plugging, and our team doctor had said, well, pick up Benadryl. And, like, I should have checked the guide and all that stuff, and I didn't. Because it just didn't occur to me.
Yeah.
It's just like, you look back and you think, God, that was so stupid. But, you know, it's just, that's where my lens was not focused on that.
And you know what, at that time, and certainly this didn't have the same kind of attention on it as the Ben Johnson scandal or anything like that. But at that time, you didn't hear a lot about these kinds of stories, right? About an over-the-counter medication causing an athlete to fail a test. Mm-hmm. You didn't hear about that kind of thing very often back then. And I think nothing else, it probably brought a lot of light for young athletes to say, hey, you know what? Read the label.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. Sometimes it takes a high-profile incident like that to kind of get, you know, everybody tuned in a little bit more. And I think it got the team doctors a lot more tuned in, but it also got, I mean, ultimately the medications in Benadryl were taken off the banned list because so many athletes were being caught for having a cold or, you know, an ear infection or whatever.
What do you do if you're a professional? You're not.
That's how dare you have allergies.
That seems allergies, which I do.
When you get stripped of a gold medal and then that banned substance is no longer a banned substance, that's got to piss you off.
They got to give back the medal.
No, I was totally happy that it's not a banned substance. It should never have been a banned substance.
Oh, and right.
There's just that thing about, you know, it takes some time sometimes to catch up and get sensible. I mean, God, if you know, in today's world, if we got pissed off about everything that wasn't sensible.
Remember the story of the snowboarder? I think he was a snowboarder, Ross Rebliati.
Yeah. Yeah.
When he tested positive for marijuana. And I'm like, you should give him an extra medal for winning while he's high.
Right.
Like, that's not performance enhancing.
That's not performance.
A whole other event.
Yeah.
Yeah. Stone snowboarding. This guy's stone a legend.
Would be amazing. Yeah.
How would you, like, it wouldn't look any different than not stone snowboarding to you guys. Like, unless you're the one stoned watching the snowboarding.
You have a few of those medals already, don't you?
So, Ken, I think back to the days when, you know, we were watching the Olympics in the late 80s, early 90s. And I mentioned earlier that you were one of the ones that was always advertised as being a huge medal hopeful for Canada. And you really were and still are to this day very much a household name. And then I think about, you know, obviously the summer games last year being postponed due to COVID-19, and we're hoping that they're going to happen this summer. But I'll tell you, I'm a sports guy. I love sports. I can't name off the top of my head more than a couple of big name Canadian medal hopefuls. And I'm wondering if that has changed a little bit, if for no other reason that we had so few when you were an active competitor, that when we made it to the podium, it was such an over-the-top, exciting thing. And now we've sort of become blasé because Canada's actually done really well in the Olympics over the last, you know, 20 years or so, or at least better than we've done in the past. I don't know. Is there a correlation there?
You know, it's hard to say, isn't it? In a way, there's so much out there now. So if you think, if you actually think back, if you can remember 20 years ago, right? You know, we had television. We didn't have podcasting. We didn't have live streaming. We didn't like the internet. Yes, but it wasn't like the way it is now, right? And now there's so much for people to consume that it's actually harder. I mean, you seem to have fewer names, and they get really, really big, and then everybody else gets confused with every, like, there's just so much information, I think, is what I'm saying. So it's harder. We when my kids were little, we used to get cable for 2 weeks, right? Mm-hmm. And that TV would be on our kitchen table, for 2 weeks straight, during dinner, doing everything, right? We'd watch all the Olympics. But now, you know, if I were to do that, the kids would also be on their phones, and they'd like
right.
their friends, and they'd be swiping and texting, you know, and oh, what's happening on Instagram, and oh my gosh, you know, and there's new platforms coming out all the time. So I think part of it is just the competition for the focus.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, I also think maybe that because of technology and the shift in our physical education in our schools, and just our emphasis on the physical, that we are losing a sense of the importance of and value of sport in our lives, which is really unfortunate.
What other sports do you love? When you you get tired of just, okay, listen, I'm a rower, but there's some other, what else do you play, watch, or into, or a big fan of?
Yeah. I don't actually row anymore.
You're connected to rowing and always will be.
I just, you know, we spent the winter in Whistler. We have a home in Whistler. So I'm a big downhill skier, cross country skier, backcountry skier. I'm getting into, I love snow. I love winter. I paddle board. I love cycling. I'm a little obsessed with cycling. I'm starting to get into mountain biking. So, you know, I had to stop myself with mountain biking last year.
No wonder you're out in the West Coast.
Yeah. Right. And I was thinking like, am I too old to learn like to mountain bike? Like, and then like, I went out with a friend who's like 20 years younger, and she's taking me off like a bridge the very first day. There should be a disclaimer at some point, but I love so many different things. I mean, I have way too many hobbies. Every time I take something else up, my husband's like, you know, but
another one.
But I do love, and I actually have to kind of almost, I'm not just so highly, you know, movement oriented that I have to be really conscious about developing the other parts of myself, because I'm also very creative and artistic, and I love to write, and, you know, but I love moving so much that moving could take up every day, all day.
So like the one Olympic event that you, so the one Olympic event you'd suck at would be standing still.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
That competition.
Both my kids have ADD, and they said to me, my daughter's
going to say,
she's like, Mom, you really should get tested. I'm like, I think it's too late. I've been high functioning. Does that count for anything?
I'll bet you if one day they do an advanced study, there is a connection between ADD and superior elite athletes, you know?
Yeah. Like,
there is something, or OCD is probably part of it too.
Yeah. That hyper focus, the ability.
Yeah.
I've been very fortunate in my professional life that I've always been able just to create my work and not have a structure that I'm forced into. And it would be impossible for me.
Yeah.
And just kind of recognizing that about myself and acknowledging it. You're right. I think there's a lot of athletes who have that hyper focus and have also that attention, you know, go all over the place.
A question I've asked a few former Olympians over the years, and I'm always curious to know their take on it. Mm-hmm. Do you ever look at the Olympics over the last, whatever it is, 3 decades, and say, what are these NBA guys doing here? What are these NHL guys doing here? Like, this is amateur sport. And why are they here? And I get it. They bring eyeballs. It brings ratings. It brings dollars. But let's leave the focus on the amateur athlete. Or do you say, hey, the more the merrier. Let's just expand the games and get as many eyes on it as we can.
I'm more likely to say, why do we still have old white guys running it?
Okay. You took a left turn on me, Silken Lauer.
Yeah, I did. Why don't we have diversity actually at the very top?
Mm-hmm.
Is it still a very unfriendly place for female leadership, particularly like there's three heads of sport in this country, three sports of all the sports out there that have women at the leadership helm. So that would be more my criticism, not so much the professional, but like, come on, it's 2021 here. Like, let's get with the program. Like, let's make this relevant. Let's make it inclusive. Let's get rid of some of the old models of leadership and, passive aggressive power and, boys clubs and all this stuff that, 30 years ago, it was like, women only started rowing in 76. But now that we're in 2021, it's like, oh, for God's sakes, I can't believe these same issues are still issues.
Mm-hmm. Is that on your to-do list?
So, yeah, I have not had a calling. And I that sounds corny, but I mean that very honestly. Like, I haven't had the calling to be a coach or to get involved in sport, but I am involved in pushing boundaries in different ways. As I'm a big advocate for mental health and working really hard on suicide prevention and some of these other issues that are so important right now during the pandemic. So I feel like my calling is different. Have I backed women who are in the system and trying to, push their way through? Yes.
So who should, you know a lot of the women that should be in this position. Who should be in there? Who should the focus be on to make this diversity happen? Who do you have in mind?
Well, I think it starts. So what we have to realize is that I'm talking amateur sport in Canada, mm-hmm. not professional sport, because I don't know as much about professional sport, but amateur sport is actually run by volunteer boards. So in our country, like rowing, for instance, would have a volunteer board, and there are people from all over, the country, and they have, and in the past, until just a handful of years ago, like two or three in Rowing Canada, their board was basically all, middle-aged to older white men of a certain demographics who used to row. And I think it's like when I was on the Right to Play board and it was all men plus one woman and then and me, two women and 14 men, we would go to nominate people, and you're always nominating what you know. So it's not like you're trying to keep it male and white. It's just those are the guys you hang out with and have beer with and play ball with. Right. And so you have to be so intentional about changing it. Like, I had to finally say, we've got to have 50% of our board as women. So if you don't know them, we've just got to be more assertive about finding the connection, and they're not going to look exactly like the men, right? Like, they might not have the same kind of jobs, because right now most CEOs are men, and most, multimillionaires in our country are still it's hard. It's not an easy thing, Chris. Like, I think it has to happen step by step. It has to happen with a lot of commitment. Like, when we put our board together for Unsinkable, we were thinking about diversity. We were thinking about diverse voices, and, because I'm a 50 something white chick, and I have a certain perspective because I grew up in a lovely little area in Mississauga. Right. Mm-hmm. But we need other perspectives. And I just think it makes us all better. It will make sport better. And we just have to be more intentional and a little bit more almost mandated, mm-hmm. which I hate. Like, hey, because I told you my number one value is freedom, right?
Right. I absolutely love hearing all of that. And I mean, obviously, if there is a knock on the sport that you competed in, it was that it really is a sport that could only ever be afforded by, the upper class. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of amateur sports that are represented in the Olympics that are very similar, right? And I think part of the reason why the sexy sports, the highest rated sports, are probably the ones that are the most attainable, like the running sports and everything else, because everyone knows what it's like to run. Not everyone can viscerally compare to the experience of a double skull, right? But I think that the work you've done with Right to Play and everything else to try and make a lot of this more accessible and not have finance be a reason why kids don't get out and get involved, I think all of that is so tremendous. And if anything, that I think becomes your legacy even more so than what you did on the amateur stage.
That's interesting. Well, our life is long, right? Our life in sport, my life in sport was 13 years, a wonderful 13 years, and a lot was done. But, you know, I've had a lot longer outside of sport than I have had in. And I've always felt, as you know, kitschy as it sounds, but like, our purpose in life is to really bring our talents and abilities and live them in our life. And so if I've got any talents as an influencer, as somebody who's quite visionary and, you know, the things that I create, I feel like it is actually on me, and it's my purpose to animate those in the world and do something with my talents and abilities. And I think it's not just, I mean, I just think we all have them, and we're not supposed to, you know, finish sport or finish whatever we're doing and go in some corner somewhere and not keep living. Like,
I don't want to understate that point, because there are a lot of former Olympians that all they did after they finished competing was open a bar, you know, and that's about it. And they have no interest in being in the public eye. They have no interest in being philanthropic or anything like that. I think that takes a different muscle. I think that's a different type of person. And I think it's amazing what you've done. Mm-hmm. Over the last couple of years, Silken, my personal journey to understanding my own mental health has been turbulent. I'll say that. It's not something I ever really talk about publicly, but it's a very real thing for me. And I'm at the point now where I'm constantly, you know, in talking to a therapist, talking to friends openly about my situation, working on, you know, my mental health, understanding my traumas, right? And trying to really cope with them. One of the most poignant things I read over the last week in preparing for tonight was a comment that you made on social media where your husband said, "What does your depression look like for you?" And I thought, man, that is really, really, really insightful, powerful question. And like, because people have said to me, "Are you depressed?" I'm like, "I don't think I'm depressed. I think I'm sad, but I don't know what depressed really looks like." And I've had to like go through therapy and wrap my head around that. But I mean, I think it's incredibly brave of you to be so public about these types of conversations. Do you ever feel trepidation about that? Do you ever feel like maybe that's going to affect the Silken Laumann brand? Or have you just embraced so much that, you know what, being transparent about my own mental health is kind of who I am right now?
What's she going to do? Lose a doctor?
Well, whittle it down to 8.
Yeah, exactly. Take one of those away from me. Yeah. Well, I wrote my book 7 years ago, and I think that when I was writing my book, I was just writing my book. Like, it was like journaling, you know. Mm-hmm. And at some level of my brain, I thought it would just kind of live on the bookshelf in a corner where nobody would see it, and then the McLean's article came out, and I was on the front cover of McLean's with this dark secret, you know, and it was like some crazy headline that was just like, whoa. Hey. And I was like, oh man. And at this point, my family was already upset, right? So like my sister and my dad were upset, and I was like, this is going to be, and I was terrified. Like, Donnie, like, I was just, and you know, I was terrified of hurting them. I was also terrified of shifting public perception of who I was, because I was that woman who had overcome this devastating leg accident and, you know, could get through anything. And here I was in my book talking about cutting, about depression so deep that, you know, rage would burst out at unpredictable times, that you know, eating disorder as a kid, and you know, a mom with an undiagnosed mental illness who would throw things in rage, and you know, the police would come. And it's really hard. First of all, it's really hard stuff to talk about.
Yeah.
Because when you're writing about it, you're, of course, you're actually going back and living and remembering how powerless you feel when you're a 7-8 year old kid. And but I had done that healing work, and I knew that my strength had also come from the wildness of living in my house as a kid, and that all the things that had been so hard and I would never want the kid next door to have to go through were also what gave me the power to overcome that accident 10 weeks before the Olympic Games, or to start a not-for-profit, or to write a book, or to raise a kid with autism. Or like, my capacity is so huge because I've lived so much, right? So
yeah,
you know what I always say to people is, like, the most important person to tell your story to is yourself. Mm-hmm. Right? So like, whether it's in therapy or to a friend or to your partner or all of the above, you just got to know what your real story is. Otherwise your story controls you in ways that you're not aware of, right? So you're literally giving your power up to the crap that you went through in the past, right? Mm. But in order to tell my story publicly, I had to really know it was the truth, and that I owned it, and that I did not carry shame anymore. I mean, I carried shame for so long. And in a way, writing that book and talking about it, and then now over the last 7 years, it's gotten a lot easier, but it was probably the single most liberating thing I've ever done in my life.
Hmm. Wow. If you weren't a champion before, your ability to communicate that pain, and I'm sure in the process helps so many other people who've read the book and heard your story. Again, as if you weren't a champion before, that's truly the mark of a champion there. And I just want to thank you for you being that transparent with the world and sharing with us tonight. That was super powerful.
And I'll say this too. Tid asked you earlier if that, you know, that first time you stood up after the injury was the worst pain ever. As you talk about that, Silken, I sort of relate. It's a different kind of pain, but the worst pain I think I've ever experienced was that first time I sat down with a therapist and we had to do a trauma history. And I talked very openly about, okay, here's all my stuff, right? Mm. And it is an extremely difficult thing to do. But you know what? I do think that with people like you, other athletes, other celebrities that have been very transparent, very straightforward, I think what it's helped to do, if nothing else, is it's helped to remove the stigma around mental health awareness. It's helped to remove the stigma around getting help. You know, it used to be like, oh, you go to a therapist. Are you crazy? No, I'm not crazy. I need help, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, if I need glasses, I'm going to go to an optometrist. If I'm sick, I'm going to go to a doctor.
Yeah.
And, you know, if my head's not right, then I'm going to go see a therapist. And I think the stigma is still there, I think, to a certain extent, but I think it is shifting and has shifted tremendously. And I think young people today have a very different view on it. And you work so closely with young people, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's one of my greatest joys, I think, is that, well, first of all, let me just respond a little bit to your own experiences and in your comment, because, you know, first of all, thank you for being so open. And, your listeners are listening and going, wow, like got these three guys here and they're like all sporty and like, you know, and they're talking about their feelings, you know, and there's, I think there's, it's hard. It's really hard for guys and athletic men. I think there's more stigma in some ways. But I think we're moving even beyond stigma now to kind of normalize this conversation about what it actually is mental health, right? And like for me, I don't know, you can't see, but behind here, I maybe you can't see, I've got mind, body, soul, right? And to me, they're all completely integrated. You can't actually be healthy without having those three aspects of your life. Well said.
Yep.
Right. And so when I think my thinking on this is that we're actually all on a continuum. Nobody is 100% mentally healthy. They're just not. You have blind spots, you have dysfunctions, you have just like weird behaviors. That where do they come from? Well, they come from somewhere. So nobody is there, right? So we all have mental health. And there are times where we move into mental illness, right? Which is when we need help, right? When, you know, OCD or, you know, maybe we have like our special needs daughter, bipolar, where we need to have medications and specialists and all sorts of kind of interactions to get back on track. But we all experience it. And I think we need a normalization of that conversation. And we have to absolutely have more help out there. So that's kind of where Unsinkable Youth and Unsinkable has come in. And, you know, when I started Unsinkable, I thought it would just be, I don't know, like a website where there'd be all these great stories that would inspire and uplift people, because I saw that I am so fortunate. I hear people's stories all the time. I mean, one of the things when I wrote my book is that people would come up to me and they weren't telling me anymore their stories of like how they overcame polio as a kid and, you know, then ran the Ironman. They were telling me like, oh yeah, no, I had an abusive father and I still, you know, and I ended this circle and I don't abuse my children. And like, we're talking like really deep stories. And I thought, what if I created a place for stories that could uplift and inspire and actually maybe move somebody along their journey because they would recognize themselves in that story. And that was really the genesis of Unsinkable. And now it's become, you know, our show Unsinkable Youth is up for a Canadian Broadcasting Award, which was like completely unexpected. I didn't even know what it was, you know, and we, you know, we're literally, I think we touched 50 million people last year on our social media platforms and wow. Like it's just exploded. And one of the things that I believe is that the helping each other is about sharing our experiences. So absolutely some of the knowledge lives in the medical community. You know, some of the knowledge lives with the therapist, but a lot of it is about people opening up about what helped them. And you see this, like, say, in like alcohol, what is it called? Al-Anon. Mm-hmm. You know, how people with lived experience are helping other people with lived experience. And that's what's happening at Unsinkable. And that was kind of unexpected to me. I thought the stories themselves would uplift, but now it's like the people are finding different ways to interact with each other. We've created youth forums and forums. We're creating events now. We have, you know, programs that you can actually sign up and learn to meditate and, you know, that where you're in a group and you're sharing with each other what you're experiencing. So the whole thing has kind of just grown organically based on what our community wants and needs. And it's just a huge joy in my life. Like I was on the phone today, we have 7 staff and we do this thing where we do the highs and the lows and what we need help on. And there's no separation between a problem or a high in your personal life or in your professional life, because I believe you bring your whole self to work. And if your high is that your kid learned to ride a bicycle this week, I that's the one I want to hear about.
Right.
Amazing. That's a great piece. And you know what? Before we say goodnight, Silken, you've been so generous with your time. I want to let everyone know that they can go to weareunsinkable.com, find out more about her foundation, which is absolutely amazing. And I know for everyone out there, finding free time is always a challenge. So I'm going to say this right here in a public forum on this show, so I can be held accountable. I'm going to find time to volunteer in some way, shape, or form for Unsinkable, okay? Because the work you guys are doing is absolutely amazing. I look at your website all the time for the last Oh my God, it's been 7 months since we've been trying to arrange to have you on the show. I've been in touch with Lori, who you work with, who's part of your team, and she's been so wonderful and so helpful. And it was just a matter of finding the opportunity to get this chance to sit down. And ever since we've been in contact, I've been on your website regularly and thinking, I have to find a way to volunteer and help out somehow. So I'm making that commitment. I will find the time and I will do that. And thank you so much. Just before we went on the air tonight, I had a quick chat with our mutual friend, Biff Naked. And she said, you guys are going to love Silken. She's the sweetest woman in the world. And she really should be the Prime Minister of Canada. Any political aspirations? You already talked about Olympic leadership.
Yeah, if things keep moving in the direction they are, you know, desperate times call for desperate measures.
Help us, save us, Dr. Silken.
Exactly.
If thank nothing else, we got a campaign to get her, like, you know, on a box of Shreddies, because like that's the Canadian version of Wheaties, right?
And you guys are in Toronto, right?
Yes, we're based in Toronto.
So, you know, one little way that people can help if they're listening, we've got a new little, you know, fundraiser awareness thing. It's the Retreat Candle, the Toronto Candle. All the money's going towards youth mental health and unsinkable youth. So you could look that up. We're on all socials under Unsinkable. Perfect. So that's great. And Donnie, I appreciate you helping. We should have a conversation about what we can do together.
Let's do that.
Thank you, guys. It was awesome.
This was a pleasure.
We appreciate your time, and hopefully we can do this again.
Take good care.
All right. Silken Lauman, everybody.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, you're welcome.
She is an absolute treasure. Unbelievable. We're so grateful for her time. We know that ran long, and we're just so grateful. What a wonderful piece.
Sometimes they run long. Sometimes they run long when they have something to say.
Well, that's just it. Some conversations get a little more important and impactful than others. And I think there's a lot of things said tonight that I don't know that any of us were exactly expecting, but probably needed. And I hope that our audience appreciates it.
It's a different kind of conversation, right, boys? And you know what? It's needed, and it's something that I think our audience will enjoy. Remember, go to weareunsinkable.com. Mm-hmm. Tid, before we say goodnight, I know that you had mentioned off the air that you wanted to do a quick Netflix shout out.
You know what? This is a movie that's been, it dropped a little while ago, but of course with the pandemic and everything like that, you know, not everybody could get and see it and whatnot, but it looks like that Netflix picked up the Eric Andre movie, Bad Trip. And it's very much along the vein of like a Borat, Sacha Baron Cohen thing, but it's Eric Andre this time around. It's the same, they had the same mentor that helped him out, that, you know, did all the Jackass stuff and everything. It's hilarious. If you're down with that kind of comedy, do yourself a favor, because Eric Andre is absolutely a hilarious human being who's willing to put himself out there into just some of the most ridiculous situations.
If you like Bad seeing trip? People in a movie that don't know they're in a movie.
Bad Trip. Okay. Yeah, exactly, right?
Yeah, all right.
But there's still a few people that get blurred out and stuff, because they're like, I ain't signing up on that. I ain't signing shit.
That makes it seem more legit to me, which is dope. I actually don't mind that.
Right?
You know what I mean?
You sign, you get paid.
And afterwards, they do a couple of things, like the reveal before they get them, you know, to sign the stuff, the reveal on it. They do a couple of those clips at the end of the movie, and then it's pretty funny because as you're watching, you're sitting there going, oh, there's some pissed off people in this one, for sure. But it was very well done, and of course, Eric Andre, good thing he didn't get shot.
My bro, Danny O, while your music is playing in the background, you got anything you want to plug before we say goodnight?
Yo, what do I want to plug right now? Go to my brand new website. I don't know if I mentioned it on the show, but it was revamped over the past couple of weeks. So DannyO.com, spelt as you know, Dan-E-O.com. All of my music and videos are there. So check it out. Just revamped it this past month.
Is this song there?
Well, I can't hear what you're hearing.
Oh, this is Bossman.
Oh, okay. Bossman, of course. Pick it up off the Inevitable album, of course. No doubt. Shouts to Chip Food.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, go to godfathersofpodcasting.com, buy some new merchandise, check out our sponsors. You know, we got stuff like this, you know. We've been podcasting since before podcasting was even called podcasting. We got a whole new line of merchandise with a new logo variant. It looks so, so sick. I've got some coming on the way for myself and friends and family. Go get yours, okay? godfathersofpodcasting.com. Until next time, That's Notorious P.I.D. Chris Tidwell. That's your bro, Danny O. Yeah. My name is Donnie Da Silva. Thanks to Silken Lauman and the entire Unsinkable Foundation for their help putting this together this week. We will see you next time.
So Lipa goes through with clear water ahead of Bredel of Belgium at halfway in this women's single sculls final. Lauman of Canada still well in touch in third place. United States and Marden, who is based in London, member of Thames Tradesmen, she's in fourth. The Mole of France in fifth, and Brandine of Sweden is sixth.
It's quite remarkable that Lauman is in contention in this race at all when you think that she underwent four major operations and had 6 weeks out of the boat at the beginning of May, June. She's been sculling 300 kilometres a week since then, however, and she is the most remarkable competitor. There we are, Silken Lauman. You can see that how her legs are strapped. The calf muscle particularly is being held because that's where the damage was. And I think it's an achievement to be in the boat, another achievement to make the Olympic final, but to be in medal contention is quite remarkable. And Lipa has pulled out about two lengths. She had a push on just after 1,000, and it's beginning to look as if the others are unlikely to get on terms with her.
The style with which we become so familiar from the Romanian competitors in virtually all their boats. Nothing subtle about it. Get out in front and catch me if you can.
And over on the far side in the blue boat, and Marden now pushing on. The second half of the course is her strength, and neither of the second and third place, there's Bredel of Belgium, are safe with Anne Marden. She's going to come on very strongly.
The Olympic best time has already been lowered three times here. Anne Marden in a heat, then Lipa in the first semi-final, then Lauman in the second. And they now go through the final checkpoint with Lipa with a substantial lead, a couple of lengths over Bredel of Belgium, Lauman of Canada, and Marden of the United States, absolutely level, sharing third place, Lamole of France in fifth, and Brandine of Sweden in sixth.
And Marden has pulled through on the far side. She's now lying in third position. She's pulled past Silken Lauman and is challenging the Belgian nearest the camera. That's really where the race is, because Elisabetta Lipa has still a good length and a half of clear water, which is a comfortable margin.
This is Anne Marden, 34 years old. Qualified for the United States team back in 1980, but didn't go because of the Moscow boycott. It's Lipa from Bredel of Belgium with Marden of the United States in third. It was deceptive there. Bredel is still looking at clear water between herself and Lipa. And Lipa now has not much more than 50 meters to go. Lipa from Bredel, who is certainly applying all the pressure she can, almost overlapping the stern of Lipa, and it's only about half a length now. Lauman has come back and gone through Marden, and that's the finishing order. Gold for Romania, silver for Belgium, and bronze for Canada.